Hi, Brian. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you. I've been following your books and your podcast for quite some time now. I really enjoyed Laws of Nature and Why Does E Equals MC Squared. The analogies you use in explaining physics, such as how mass and energy are interchangeable like euros and dollars, is so fascinating. It makes people like me in humanities really understand physics. And now there's even a course in Columbia University named Physics for Poets. In light of this, how do you think the world would be a different place if more people knew about physics?
Oh, I think if more people knew about nature in general, let's say, not just physics. And I always think of one of my great heroes that inspired me was Carl Sagan, of course, Cosmos, very famous. But Carl Sagan said that astronomy is humbling and character building. And so the humbling bit is kind of easy, right? I mean, we now know that the Earth is one planet around one star amongst 400 billion stars in one galaxy, amongst 2 trillion galaxies in one patch of a potentially infinite universe. Itself may be one little bubble universe in an infinite sea of universes called the inflationary multiverse. So anyway, humbling is really easy. But the character building bit is that when you think a bit about what we are, for example, let's think about what a human being is. We allow the universe to study itself. So suddenly you're elevated. You think, well, I'm not just this sort of thing that lives a short life and then disappears and there's no point to it all. You could scientifically say, well, you're a collection of atoms. Some of them as old as time, right? The hydrogen atoms, and so the rest of them were made in stars. So that's incredible. And it's in this pattern that can think and feel and explore the universe and write music and do all the things that we do. So science gives you this perspective, which is, I think, so valuable and changes the way that anybody who studies science for a moment thinks about their place in the universe. The character building bit, by the way, is that in the show, I make this argument. I say that it's possible that the number of planets in a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, where there are collections of atoms like us that can explore the universe, on average, that number of planets might be none or one. There might be one civilization per galaxy. We don't know, but it's a possibility. And I make an argument, a guess, an argument in the show for that. So the character building bit, and again, it goes back to Carl Sagan. He said, the thing about our place in the universe is, remarkable as it is, there's no one coming to save us from ourselves. So suddenly we have this overwhelming responsibility. And you realize, as well as being fortunate, that we better not make a mess of this. So that's the long answer to the question, but the value of science goes way beyond just finding out how things work. It can, in the hands of people like Carl Sagan, it becomes a way of trying to understand our value.
Absolutely. I think it really does affect responsibility as humans, knowing that we might be the only intelligent form of life in the Milky Way. Just playing with the big questions, really. I'm sure, I don't know if your son has ever asked you this, but I sometimes work with teenagers. The question I get the most is, where do we come from? As a parent, what do you think is the most dignified answer to that big question?
Well, it's interesting. You can answer it to some extent. So you can tell the history of the evolution of life on Earth. And we can speculate to some extent about how it may have begun. And we have some theories, and maybe we can test them. That's one of the reasons we're on Mars at the moment, looking to see if life began on Mars. But ultimately, you keep going backwards. And you get to very deep questions indeed about such as, where did the universe come from? Did the universe have an origin? Why are the laws of nature such that life can exist in the universe? And the answer ultimately is we don't know. So also, and that's extremely important as well. Richard Feynman, there's a few of my heroes I'm talking about. Richard Feynman's another one. Wrote a wonderful essay called The Value of Science in 1955. Actually, part of that motivation for him was he'd worked on the Manhattan Project with Robert Oppenheimer and others. So he felt partly responsible for the bomb, the atom bomb, which could still destroy us. And so he said, ultimately, what you learn from trying to understand nature at the deepest level is you end up with this, as Carl Sagan said again, humility. Right? You end up realizing that we don't know everything. And in admitting that, he called it the open channel. So he said that the very statement, when you say, I don't know, that's, you have to say that in order to make progress, first of all. Because if you think you know everything, you don't try and learn anything. So there'd be no science without anyone saying, I don't know. But the having the confidence to do it in the face of the deepest questions. I don't know. I don't know how the universe began. I don't even know if it began. Right? It might be eternal for all I know. It's true. We know there was this big bang thing 13.8 billion years ago. It was really hot and dense. We don't know whether that was the origin to the universe at all. So I love the idea. I love saying I don't know. I like standing on the edge of the known and peering into the unknown and go, I don't see fear there. I see it's opportunity and excitement. So that's really, really important, I think. So Feynman was right. The value of science ultimately is nature. It's such a harsh teacher, right? It doesn't care. That's one of the reasons I just said why it's great for children and students watching to do science in schools. Because one of the things it teaches you immediately, if you're doing an experiment, let's say you're swinging a pendulum and you swing it and you go, I think it's going to do this. I think it's going to, it doesn't care. Nature doesn't care. It just does it. And so it doesn't matter how important you are or how rich you are or how whatever it is, you're just wrong. You can be wrong. Nature will just say you're wrong. And you
that's go, okay. Humbling. Yeah, that is a very dignified answer and really, really humbling. And you mentioned Feynman and Oppenheimer, and given the ethical complexities that was kind of associated with them and developing the atomic bomb, how do you think that would parallel into the current really advanced advancements in AI? And how do you think policymakers and government officials should navigate such ethical dilemmas? Because I know you're really interested in politics as well. How do you think we should handle these?
That's a great question, because you're right. In principle, we haven't solved quite the opposite. We haven't solved the problem of the bomb, right? It's true that we haven't detonated one in anger since 1945, but that doesn't mean we're not going to. We've got plenty of them lying around. We could easily destroy our civilization. And as we've discussed before, in doing so, we might destroy all intelligent life in a galaxy forever. So we maybe should think about that. But and you're right. So the way that we regulate technologies, genetic engineering technologies, AI, those things, that we can learn lessons from our complete failure to deal with the knowledge that we generated in the 1940s in the Manhattan Project. It's utter failure that everybody has these things now. That shouldn't have happened. And it's interesting to look back in the history. You will see Oppenheimer, for example, trying to argue that the only real way to control that technology was to make it freely available and regulate globally. Global regulation is something that we've not solved. You see it with the challenges, climate. You'll see it through with AI. You saw it with nuclear weapons. We're just not good at it. And so I think what science is good at is one of the things it's good at is collaboration, global collaboration. There really are no national boundaries or, you know, boundaries of different belief, and it doesn't really exist in science so much. I mean, a great example. Last night, I was asked. I was giving a talk at Imperial College in London, and it was to celebrate the life and work of Abdus Salam, who's Nobel Prize winner, the Standard Model of Particle Physics, like one of the greats, right? And he spent it was almost 50-50. He spent half his life doing fundamental research, but a lot of time building an institute in Italy called INFN, which is built specifically to have scientists from all over the world come and work in it and very specifically from countries that developing countries or countries that are developing their science base. Right. So a lot of African nations send a lot of physicists there, for example. And it was this idea that this quest for knowledge is absolutely universal. It breaks down all barriers and all boundaries. And indeed, as Abdus-Salam felt very strongly, that the more different viewpoints, the more people you can get from different cultures who've come through different systems into a single place to think about problems, the more likely you are to solve them. So it's not some kind of, you know, just like some romantic desire, having the peoples of the world come together and it's kind of nice. It's that it's these different perspectives that people have that, as I said, different nationalities, different belief systems, whatever it is, you get those people working together and you have a greater chance of not only having a harmonious future, but solving the problems that we face. I really strongly believe that.
I really do hope so. I like that in one interview, you say that with your taxes, you would even have the prime ministers go to space to understand the vastness of things. I really do. We can hope that we can collaborate and find answers. I'd like to play this game of free word association, where okay. I just say one word and you say the first thing that comes to your mind. All right, we'll go. Black hole.
Mystery.
Adolescence.
Adolescence?
Yes.
The human race. We're in our adolescence, right?
Music.
Beauty.
Artificial intelligence.
Can I have two words? Threat and opportunity.
Death.
Inevitable.
Time?
Time? No idea.
Yeah.
We don't even know what a clock is. It's one of the, I was looking at this recently for another project. It's what actually is a clock? You might be surprised to know that we don't know what they're measuring. Einstein famously said, what does a clock do? It measures time. It doesn't say what time is. And it's a really live area of research. What is a clock? It's something to do with thermodynamics. It's like a little steam engine thing. Someone said it was an entropy flow meter that I read somewhere. So it suddenly gets very complicated very quickly. So, the simplest of concepts. If you dig, you find that they're very complicated.
Absolutely. I wouldn't know how to describe it at all. And we're really excited for you to visit Turkey and bring your show Horizons, especially at a time where we're just like locked in our phones and we're just in small things. And in Horizons, you take us to realities we didn't even know existed. So in light of that, what do you think about further space colonization, especially Mars colonization? Should there be a limit for humans, or is it just going to be more and more like that Asimov's short novel where it's the last question and you start off with different planets and then galaxies and then forever? Should there be a limit?
No, I hope there isn't a limit, because I mean, I tend to start from this assumption that maybe civilizations are very rare. And so if that's the case, then it follows that if we don't go out there and experience these places and expand our civilization, nobody will. There's nobody else, I think, we're certainly in the neighborhood, to do that. So we have these places, the moon and the asteroids and Mars, they're unlimited resources, so unlimited real estate and unlimited potential. And so I think ultimately we have to do it, of course, ultimately. The question becomes when. There's no better time than now, I suppose. Having said that, I think that going to Mars is very, very, very difficult. It's way more difficult than anything we've done before. So I don't think we know how to do it yet, really, to have humans in space in a much more violent environment, by the way, than the space station, to be there for 2 years or something like that, that mission would take. Is, I think, beyond us at the moment. So I expect we'll be on the moon. We'll be on the moon pretty soon. I wouldn't be surprised if we start building big bases on the moon. I think we're talking decades before we get to Mars. That is my view. I don't think it's too hard, actually.
Yeah, we might be overstretching. So as a last question, it's great that you're a musician and you're in physics. What are the correlations in quantum physics and music? I know it's in the simplest way possible.
I mean, I suppose there's one answer which I'll give, which is they're both wave-like things. there's often a description of atoms. You see people's chapters in books about them called the music of the atoms, because it's true that the electrons behave like guitar strings in some sense. When you put them around an atom, then you have to fit a certain number of vibrations of the string around the atom, and that gives you atomic structure, which gives us chemistry and allows us to exist. So there's that kind of correlation. And actually, if you look at the sorts of waves in a hydrogen atom, if you look at the way the electrons behave in their wavy way around the nucleus, they look very much like the waves if you take a basketball, for example, and hit it, the waves in the basketball look like the waves, the electron waves, the so-called wave function of the electrons in the atom. So it's kind of a correlation there. But I'd also give a different answer, that I recently did a collaboration just before Christmas at the Sydney Opera House with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. And the idea was to have a conversation between music and the physics, science, astronomy, cosmology. And so these great composers, we use Strauss, who everyone knows, that there's a great piece that also spoke Zarathustra. Everyone knows the start of it from 2001. No one knows the other 20 odd minutes, which are better than the first bit. Everybody says it's the best bit is the bit you never hear. So that, and some Mahler and Sibelius and these wonderful pieces of music. And the idea was to try and see if the ideas that come from cosmology and astronomy and quantum mechanics, these strange ideas, are kind of amplified and change their character when you put this great symphonic music against it. And I really believe they did. I think it was a fascinating thing. So I think music is, I strongly believe that there's a kind of whatever this question is, the mystery of existence, right? Imagine it as this thing. And what we do is we shine lights on it and we see the shadows. So we just have access to the shadows. And science is a light, and music is a light, and literature and philosophy and theology and all the things that we do, they're lights, and they cast different shadows. And so I think the real value of all these art forms, and science is an art, is that we need as many shadows as possible, because the mystery of existence is a tricky one. We don't have the answer yet.
Yeah, I really like that. I hope we can collaborate, all countries, nations, and find answers to these questions. Well, thank you so much for that, Brian. We're really looking forward to hosting you in Turkey and having your show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.